The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
But the feeling in the body in particular being pleasant or unpleasant, we often confuse that as actually being body. But that feeling tone, that aspect of feeling is actually a mental experience. And I gave some examples last week that could help us to understand how that feeling is actually created by the mind. So in terms of exploring the body and mind, there are many places where there's a tight coupling between emotions and body, between feeling and body. Very tight coupling, almost so close that it's hard to tell them apart. But it's really helpful to start to explore this distinction, because the mind, our mental experience, is where our reactivity is created. It's how we get into our struggles, into our difficulty, into our stress. Something comes in through our sense doors. We experience things through the body, but very rapidly it goes into our mental realm. And that's where the reactivity is created. We experience something in the body and it's pleasant. That pleasantness itself is mental, and we in our minds react to it. We like it, we want it. We want more of it. Something's unpleasant, we don't like it, we want to get rid of it. We get averse to it. We feel like we have to control or manipulate or change somehow. So the we think in some ways, you know, in terms of our experience, we think we're reacting to what's coming in through the sense doors, but actually we're reacting to what's happening in our own minds. And this exploration is even more there's an even more fundamental aspect of this exploration of things coming in through the sense doors and then being interpreted by the mind is in this realm of creating concepts. What we can call the experience or process of perception. So this is a very natural, normal part of our experience. I mean, we wouldn't be able to function without it. It happens in our minds, the process of recognizing experience. This is basically what this process of perception is. We see the walls and we recognize them as walls. We see the chairs and we recognize them as chairs. We see people and recognize them as male, female. That recognition process is a process in the mind that's connected to memory, basically, that through repeated exposure to things, we learn. It's kind of we create a shortcut in a kind of a way, a shortcut that helps us to identify and recognize things quickly. And our minds do this so fast. So this process is a very important process for us to be able to live, to be able to navigate our environment. And yet it is also a very important process for us to understand from the perspective of our of how our minds work in terms of getting us into struggle and suffering and into reactivity. Because very much we don't, that the process of reactivity actually comes out of those perceptions more than the direct experience. So I want to go through that and unpack that a little bit tonight and explore this aspect of our mental experience. It's a subtle aspect in a way. I mean, it's a very obvious one. It's something that we all know happens. And yet it happens so fast that we don't really see it as a process. It's just the way things are. So, you know, when I'm looking out at the room, I'm not so particularly aware of the mind going, male, female, 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 male, male. I'm not aware of that. It just happens. It happens so fast. But there's so much that is coming in. I mean, basically the eye takes in form and color. And beyond that, it's all processed by the brain, by the mind. And so the fact that we can see and make sense of the world is due to our minds. And because of that, that process, we also tend to create beliefs, ideas, views about what we are seeing and react to those. So, this process of perception is kind of a layered process. So I just mentioned that, what comes in through our eye is just form and color. So, like this bell, from this angle for you guys is kind of round and brown. That's what the basic sight is of this. So those are perceptions. The roundness of it, the brownness of it, those are perceptions. They're related, they're kind of more related to the form and color, but they are perceptions. We recognize, oh, that's brown or that's round. And then on top of that, layered is the idea of bell. So here is a bell. That's a concept. In a different context, if I were a monastic, I might be walking around holding this, and it might be a bowl instead of a bell. So the recognition happens in our minds, and it often depends on context. So there's kind of this layered nature, putting things together. So we can start to see this process. I just want to talk a little bit about seeing this in our experience. What we did in the guided meditation was a little short, and sometimes it takes a little bit more of a quiet mind to be able to notice this kind of activity. But when we were sitting, some cars went by, and I think there was an airplane that flew overhead, and, I saw kind of, even though my eyes were open, I could see this, like, image almost of an airplane, and so that we can actually start to recognize or see there's a process happening in our minds that recognizes things. Did anybody have a sense of that? I didn't know whether it was quite enough time for you to get a sense of that, but hopefully perhaps you got a flavor of that or a taste of that. And when I rang the bell at the end, it's like there's clearly, there's the sound and there's, oh, the end of the sitting, This bell has a meaning. So not only is there the sound and the recognition of it, there's a meaning we put to it. So this experience of perceiving, of recognizing, can come about in our minds in a couple of different ways. It might, as I mentioned in the guided meditation, it might be that you actually say the word in your mind. A car goes by and you hear the mind saying car. You just hear that word pops up in your mind, or you see a picture of a car, an image of a car, or perhaps you even envision yourself driving in the car down the road. I've had that experience before. Those are the main two ways, that we perceive things. Although right now, we can sometimes perceive things through the kinesthetic feeling in the body as well. And to give you a flavor of this, right now, just imagine standing up. Just the feeling of standing up. What can you feel that in your body? Is there a little bit of a sense? To me, at least, when I imagine it, it's almost like the body kind of does it in advance or something. So there's also a way that we can recognize experience through the kind of feeling in the body. It may be a mental idea, it may be a word, it may be an image, and it can also be a feeling, this perceptual recognition. So with respect to this talk, what I'd like to point to is the fact that we often confuse or conflate body and mind around perception. So the perception is a mental experience, and yet we take it to be the reality of experience. So body parts, thinking about body parts, for instance. You know, body parts, body parts are an idea. We don't feel hand. We don't feel shoulder. We feel pressure. We feel tension. We feel heat. We feel coolness. We feel warmth. We feel tingling and pulsing and tightness and twisting. We don't feel shoulder. Shoulder is an idea. And yet often when I talk to people and ask them, okay, so what are you feeling right now? And before they've had much experience, they may say, well, I'm feeling my shoulder. And that's coming through the concept. So there's a way that, especially around the body, we mix up these two. We take the concept of our bodies to be the reality of our bodies. Now, this is, you know, not surprising in a way. You know, I'm just reading this book, a really interesting book about the neurological basis for the self. And it talks about how this process of self is formed fundamentally on this kind of mapping that we do, this kind of conceptual mapping, particularly of our bodies. We map, the brain maps our bodies. And the whole notion of the reason why the brain maps the body is because it's very efficient to model the body in the brain and then make decisions without like having to go all the way out to the body and back. You can make decisions about what to do and what needs to happen with respect to keeping the body healthy and safe by basically protecting this map in the mind. And so, you know, it kind of makes sense to me that we've confused them because it's a very tight coupling between the body and the mind around this perceptual link. But we can mix them up. We can confuse them. So there's some ways that this perceptual process is misunderstood, and this is a big one. This is a big way that the perceptual process is misunderstood. We mistake the concept for the experience. There's also a belief kind of in solidity around concepts. You know, that the experience of hand, when you feel your hand, there's not much solidity to the feeling. You know, there can be a sense of weight or heaviness, but if you put your attention in your hands right now, it's a very lively experience. There's pulsing and tingling and vibration and maybe some coolness, maybe a feeling of pressure or stiffness. There's not a lot of stability in that feeling. And yet the concept lays a kind of stability on it. It solidifies the experience to have the concept. So concepts, because of the way our minds work, repeating, like it's like we repeat a concept so rapidly in our mind, it stabilizes and kind of becomes a solid sense of something. And this is one of the fundamental ways that we misunderstand our perceptions. I'm going to give you an example about this, and it's one of the ways that we're fooled into thinking things are permanent. This kind of process in our minds that create the solidity. It's a really fundamental process that makes us believe in the permanence of things. Maybe not this car will last forever or I will live forever, but that there's a sense of some kind of permanence there. And that comes from this perceptual process. There was an example of how the mind creates something from a flow of experience. It was just so clear at the Exploratorium. I think some of you may have heard me describe this. The Exploratorium is a science museum in San Francisco. And I went there with my nephew some number of years ago. And when we walked into the Exploratorium, one of the first things I noticed was on the ceiling, hanging on the ceiling, you know, kind of spaced about 4 feet apart were these long bars. They were maybe 4 feet, maybe 6 feet long. They were pretty long bars, and they were hanging about, spaced every 4 feet. There were maybe 10 or so of these bars hanging, so there were like 40 feet of space on the ceiling. These bars were there, and there was flashing lights on the bars. And I looked up at it, and I thought, I wonder what that is. That's kind of interesting. I'll have to check that out later. And we wandered through the rest of the exhibit, and at one point, my nephew and I were sitting down and having a drink, and he was looking up in the direction of the bars, and he said, "It's a school bus." And I looked up, and I saw the flashing lights on the bars, and they were kind of yellow, and there was a little bit of red here and there, and I thought, well, it's the right color for a school bus, but I don't see a school bus up there. I see these bars. And then he said, "It's butterflies." I said, "What are you talking about?" And, you know, it took me a while, actually, but I stood there. I just stood there and I looked at the bars, and it was just kind of a way of, I guess, kind of moving your eyes just at the right speed. And what happened was that the 40-foot wide by 6 foot long area became a screen. And you could see a school bus driving across the screen. There was no screen there. It was all created in the mind. But it was so clear and so vivid that I could read the name of the school district on the side of the school bus. It was that detailed. It was kind of amazing to see what the perceptual process can do. And then it turned into butterflies, and and then it turned into fish, and it was just an amazing exhibit about perception and how it works. So the perceptual process creates things that aren't necessarily there in our experience. So this perceptual process is prone to error. And this is another way that we misunderstand the perceptual process. You know, we really believe our perceptions. We take things in and it's like, yes, I saw that. I felt that. That happened. And largely it is relatively reliable. But it does make mistakes. This process does make mistakes. So, for instance, you know, the classic kind of mistake is walking into a room with a dim light and seeing a coiled something in the corner that you think is a snake, but it turns out to be a rope. You know, so that's a kind of a perceptual mistake. I had an example of this on one retreat in Burma. Every evening around the same time, it was around dusk, I heard this squealing sound, and I was almost always in the meditation at that point, and the squealing sound to me, there was a village very nearby, you know, the monastery is kind of right in the area of where there was a village, and you could hear the noise of the village coming over the monastery walls, the loudspeakers, the sound of what was going on in the village, and the squealing sound to me sounded like a pig. That was kind of the pattern matching that my mind did around that squealing sound. I had heard pigs squeal, and this kind of sounded like that. So my mind thought pig. You know, that was the perception that the mind created around this sound was pig. Not only that, it created a little more than that, because the squealing sounded distressed to me, and I thought, this was the nightly butchering of the pig in the village. So that's what the mind created. It created the the idea of pig, and it created this idea of the pig being slaughtered. And so there's a lot of compassion that was aroused in this experience. And then some days, weeks, I don't know how long it was into the retreat, one evening I was walking at dusk instead of sitting in my room, and I saw all of these kind of things kind of flying by, and they were bats, and they were squealing. And I realized that that was what I had been hearing. Now, that is, you know, that is a mistake in the perception. You know, my pattern matching in the mind didn't know what bats sounded like, and it just wasn't in the realm of understanding that sound could be a bat.
The so, bats are really
so the perceptual process was doing its best job, but it was wrong. And the next night when I was meditating and heard the sound of the bat, it was like, you know, there wasn't the compassion that came up anymore. It's like, there's no pig being slaughtered here. So there's that process of error that can happen. You know, the fact that our perceptual process is just prone to error. Yet we believe it. We really believe what goes on in our minds. You know, if I had never seen the bats, I might have come back and just reported, yes, there were pigs in the village and they were being slaughtered. And here was this was my response. And it was completely in my mind. It was just in my mind. And then the perceptual process is also prone to error because we see things not just kind of through just bare or raw. We see things through our views and our filters. So most of us have some kind of an orientation to the world. There's a kind of a familiar teaching around Buddhist psychology that talks about, you know, most of us have one of three orientations, and we all have a mixture of these orientations, but we may tend to see the world through the filter of pleasant, of liking things, of wanting things, of kind of a greedy personality. Or we may tend to see the world through this lens of not liking, of aversion. Or we may see the world through the lens of kind of not connecting, of being kind of spaced out and not really meeting experience. So in going into a room, for instance, you know, most people have some, if I just ask you to imagine going into a room for the first time, what is it that you're drawn to? What do you see first? Do you see the things that you like? The beautiful flowers, the peaceful scents in the room? Or do you see the things you don't like? The walls are kind of bare. You know, it's really kind of boring in here. That's a kind of an orientation that's almost not seen. It's a filter that we meet experience with. And those filters can really impact how we perceive things. So one time on a retreat, I was in this place of having an incredible aversion attack. I was doing walking meditation, and I just did not like walking with people around. And, you know, every time somebody else came in and we were a little bit closer together, it'd just be even worse. And so I was just noticing this aversion and working with the aversion. And then I saw somebody's shoes down at the other end, and it was like, who put their shoes there? You know, it's like what I was seeing and my response to it was coming through this filter of aversion. So how we perceive is greatly impacted by our predispositions. There's another great study. I mean, another, before I tell you about the study, I'll just kind of put it in a context. Or sometimes when we think something is important, we see the things that we think are important and we don't see other things. And so that's another way that this perceptual process is prone to error. We see, we tend to filter things based on what we think is important and meaningful, and we tend to miss a lot of things. And there was a study done about this, and I've talked about this, some of you may have heard me talk about this too. But it's kind of an amazing, amazing study. They showed people a video of people playing basketball, and they asked people in the video, you know, their job for this research study was to count the number of times the basketball passed between the people in the white shirts. And so that was their job. They sat there and they watched the video and counted the number of times the ball passed between these people. And then they asked the people afterwards, okay, and did you notice anything else or anything unusual about the video? And somebody said something, well, yeah, was there a gorilla on the court? And most of the people were saying, no, there wasn't a gorilla on the court. And they played the video back. And indeed, for about 2 minutes of this video, this guy comes out in a gorilla suit and dances around the court. And it's like, you cannot not see the gorilla. But they didn't see the gorilla because it was not what was important. Yeah.
No, I was just saying that I started laughing when you told that story because I've seen it used in a management training session about perception. And it was hysterical because she said to count the number of times the ball has passed. And everybody was diligently counting. And then she says, okay, who saw the gorilla? You know, and it was like, you know, what gorilla? And then she's played it again, and she says, watch carefully. And, you know, I'll be darned if you stop counting the ball, the gorilla went walking by. It was pretty effective.
Yeah, it's amazing. And it's so we trust our experience so much that there are people that will say, it's a different video. You know, that we just don't believe that it could possibly, I would have seen that, they think. But no, we don't. Yeah, go ahead.
So I also was in a class recently where they played this video, and I asked the question afterwards, if we were counting the number of people that were passing the ball with the people in the black shirts, would we have seen the gorilla? You know, has somebody done that? And yes, people, if you're watching the black players, you see the gorilla because...
It's black, it's dark. Interesting.
If your attention is on the black, you see the gorilla.
Interesting.
But if you're focusing on the white, your mind erases everything.
I hadn't heard that aspect of it. So, yeah, so it's like the color aspect being really important.
It's totally black and white. There are players in white shirts and players in black shirts.
Uh-huh.
And the gorilla is...
It's kind of dark,
The black that you are consciously trying to disregard.
Right, yeah. Interesting. So those are some ways that our perceptual process can lead us astray. And then there's the way that the perceptual process figures into reactivity. And this is a big one. This is actually a really important piece to be aware of in terms of our understanding our minds and understanding, you know, reactivity and... the states that we get into kind of regularly in our lives, states of anger, frustration, irritation, aversion, hostility, cruelty, avarice, excitement, all kinds of states that can tend to agitate us. This is why we suffer. This is largely why we suffer. And to understand this process of how it happens in our minds gives us a doorway. It's like when we see that this is a process that's happening in our minds, we begin to see that we have a way to choose to not go there. Before I started meditating, before I started really exploring how my mind worked, I had no idea that I could have a choice about whether I got angry. That I could have some say in the matter, that there could be some input. I just figured this is the way it is, you know? So learning about our minds and understanding how these processes work, it begins to educate our mind. And not only do we end up feeling perhaps like we have a little bit of a say in things, we can recognize, oh yeah, I see myself kind of heading in that direction and I can just kind of let that go. I don't need to think about those, that thing that's making me feel so reactive right now. I can turn my attention to something else. But we also see that through this process of meditation, through attending to all of how our reactivity is created and what the reactivity feels like, the mind begins to understand that this isn't the way it really wants to go. The mind itself kind of has a... When it understands that it's contributing to its own suffering, it starts to let it go. And so it's really important to see how all of these processes work and interact together. And so the perceptual process comes into play in our reactivity. And it goes kind of like this. We start with some experience, say an itch. And we notice that itch, you know, so there's the sensation. We start with the bare sensation of the itch, and it kind of feels, if you actually pay attention to the itch, it often just feels like this kind of zzzed on and then off, and then zzzed, zzzed. It's kind of just this like vibratory, intense sensation that comes and goes in this one spot. That's the itch. That's the sensation. That's the kind of bare experience of the itch. And then the itch itself, the feeling is just the feeling. Then the itch itself, the itch is the concept. It's like, I have an itch. That's the concept of that feeling. Then we might, so that's the kind of bare perceptual process. We have the feeling, and then there's the identification of the experience. That's the perception. And then we start to think. Perception is really close to thinking. And this is also a place where we tend to get pulled off in meditation. If you watch your minds in meditation, where your thinking process begins usually begins from some kind of perception that you didn't notice. You're sitting there in meditation and the car drives by and you say car in your mind and then you start thinking about car. Because it's very close. The perceptual recognition of car comes almost as a thought, or it's very similar to a thought. And then we start thinking. So there's some thoughts around this itch. Maybe something like, oh, an itch. Wonder where I got that itch. Well, I was gardening. Maybe I got bit by a mosquito. Okay, so these are just some thoughts that might be coming up. And then we move from thinking into mosquitoes. They carry West Nile virus. What if that mosquito had West Nile virus? And I get really sick. I don't have very good insurance. What am I going to do? Maybe I'm going to have to get a second job. Do you recognize this? Do you recognize this process? The Buddha had a word for this process. It's a great word. I love the fact that there's a word. It's papancha. This is the process. Papancha. This is where our reactivity just mushrooms. Papancha, sometimes translated as mental proliferation. I like the translation, the mind run amok. It's kind of what it feels like. Just the mind, it's mushrooming. It gets lost in that proliferation. Papancha is the leading cause of wandering mind in our meditation. So this process happens really fast. We move from the itch, from the feeling, the actual sensation, to the identification, to the thinking, to the papancha in a split second. So it happens really fast. And within the papancha is often the place where the reactivity comes to fruition. I mean, if you even just look at what's happening in the mind. I mean, you're sitting there, there's the itch, you're sitting in meditation, there's the feeling, there's the recognition of itch, there's the, oh yeah, yesterday I was gardening. And then there's the West Nile, oh no, second job, how am I going to do it? And we're in a state of reactivity because of that mental proliferation. So this really points to how our minds create the disturbances, our own disturbances, how our minds create the suffering, moving from perception to thinking to this proliferation. And this is also a place where we start to see just how much of confusion there is between the mind and the body. And so another simple example, and again, to see how the papancha leads back into how we see our experience. So once we've had this proliferation, you know, if we were proliferating about mosquito bites and West Nile virus, if there's some other itch on our body, it's probably going to send us into a really quick reactivity. It's not going to go through this kind of staged fashion. It's going to drive us nuts really fast because we already have this view in our minds that we've got West Nile and we're going to have to get another job. So we're already freaked out. And then there's this itch coming back. So we see our experience through this papancha. So another example, a kind of a simple example, you know, hearing a motorcycle go by. This one, perhaps, you know, a motorcycle, you know, the hearing of a motorcycle, it's basically pretty neutral. The sound itself, it just kind of, you know, it crests and goes off. So there's the sound, and then there's the recognition of motorcycle. Now, we may have some ideas and beliefs about motorcycles. Or we may have some ideas and beliefs about motorcycles on Hopkins Street. Now, these ideas and beliefs might lead to some kind of reaction, a subtle reaction that makes us perceive, I mean, happening so fast, makes us perceive that sound as either pleasant or unpleasant. Now, in meditation, maybe many of you would perceive that sound as unpleasant. But it's coming, the unpleasantness of that experience, so this is kind of tying together several of the things we've talked about. There's the sound of the hitting the ear, which is the body. Then there's the identification, the motorcycle. Then there's a belief that's kind of underneath that feeds back, and then we kind of perceive that sound through that belief, and we feel pleasantness or unpleasantness based on that belief. And then, because of that pleasantness or unpleasantness, we may have a reaction. And that reaction may be actually where the proliferation comes from. So, for instance, you hear the motorcycle, you know, you experience, you notice it's a motorcycle, and then you recognize, yeah, that's unpleasant, you know. They really ought to, you know, IMC ought to talk to the Redwood City and have them put some speed bumps on Hopkins so that they have to slow down. Or maybe they should put up a sign that lets people know there's meditation happening here, you know. They really shouldn't be making so much noise out there while we're meditating. And we're off again. You know, we're off because of this process. Now, when we can start to see the process of perception, when we can start to see it, we have a chance to kind of recognize, oh yeah, motorcycle. We actually just see the mind has noticed motorcycle, and it can stop there. It doesn't have to go on to the proliferation. So the recognition of this process of perception can be just as key in our having a kind of a wedge in the door around stopping this proliferation of reactivity, as is the recognition of the feeling of pleasant or unpleasant. I talked last week about noticing pleasant and unpleasant, and pleasant and unpleasant being kind of the basic springboard for reactivity. The perception can feed back into this pleasant, unpleasant, and so if we can also catch the perception, we can start to... Hang on just a sec. We can start to not only see how our minds do things, but just have the perception appear and just go on with the next thing so that we're not reacting to what we're perceiving. Yeah, in the back. Pass the mic back.
I just had a story along. I don't think that one. Okay. Just what you're saying about pleasant versus unpleasant and then the perception and how that, you know, really impacts that. I was on Rainier a few years ago on a fundraiser climb, and one of the other climbers, this was his first climb ever, said to me, you know, how are you feeling during a break? And I said, oh, I'm doing great. And I said, how are you doing? And he said, well, I'm not doing so well because I'm tired, my muscles are burning, my feet hurt, I'm hungry, I'm thirsty, I'm not sure if I'm going to make it. And I said, well, I feel all those things too, but that's normal. So that's why I'm great. He's like, really? This is normal? I said, yeah. This is climbing. And the entire rest of the time, he had like a completely different attitude. He's having a good time because this is normal.
This is so normal, yeah.
It's unpleasant, it's suffering, but this is part of the experience. And it's just that like reorienting of the perception, it's still, you know, actually acknowledging the same sensation.
Exactly. That's
a
great
totally,
example.
But a totally different experience and lasted for days.
Yes, so, great. So that's a great example. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyone else have any comments? And basically, I have just one last little thing to say, but we're basically, I'm ready to open it up for questions. Yeah.
I was listening to Terry Gross a couple of days ago, and she was talking to a CIA agent. And she asked him if he had predicted what happened in Egypt, because that was his area of specialty. And he said, no, he didn't, and there was no way for anybody to have known that was going to happen. And about a week before, there was a TV program where they were interviewing these students who were sort of getting ready to demonstrate, and I was just taken by the fact that the CIA agent was totally looking in the wrong direction. He and the people in the TV program were seeing the same input, but they were totally processing it differently.
Yes, this is another example of, and it's like views and opinions, beliefs and perceptions are so intimately connected. And I will talk some about beliefs next week, because beliefs is such a big place, again, of, you know, unseen beliefs are a large part of why we suffer and why we misperceive things. So, yes, that's a great example, too. Anyone else have any? Yeah. Here.
I want to thank you for the word papancha, because I live with so much papancha. I didn't know this word existed.
It's a great word.
I'm not really the papancha-y. It's more like
you're being papanched.
I'm being papanched all the time. So it's interesting because I think that concept is really the basis of anxiety disorders and panic attacks, which is what I live with in my household. And I have a daughter who's now a teenager, but as a young child, my husband took her to the tech museum and they saw this wonderful program on the body because she was so fascinated by how everything worked. And he thought she was just loving it. And then she came home and The next thing we knew, she was in bed and she put her hand on her and she could feel her heart beating. And she was completely punched into the point where she thought she was having a heart attack. And then we had to tell the fire department lived around the corner and that they did CPR, and she had to study what CPR was. She was like six. And then we had to show her the Kaiser book and how. And then it got to the point where she couldn't stay with anybody that didn't have CPR training.
Wow.
I had CPR training, but I couldn't leave the house because my husband didn't. So we had to take him for training, you know. And over the years, spent a lot of time with mindfulness. And this is a really interesting concept that some schools are very good about bringing in, her school calls it balance day, where they bring in people that do meditation and also are health professionals to try to help them see that your teen brain is punching, not connecting all the dots because they spin, right? And my husband has the same thing, but actually it's a genetic thing that comes through his family, it's anxiety disorders. But this is a very interesting concept for them to learn.
It absolutely is. And you know, there's somebody that came to me in an introductory class, and he talked about his panic attacks, and the way he was trying to navigate them was to kind of change the thoughts. You know, it's like, you know, recognize, okay, I'm having all these thoughts that this is happening, so maybe I should change the thoughts. Maybe I should think, you know, there's no reason to be having these thoughts. And I said, well, I'm going to suggest something else for you entirely. I'm going to suggest you just notice what is happening. Just come into the actual physical experience. And within 2 weeks, he was unusual, I think. I don't know that everybody can have this kind of dramatic response, but within a couple of weeks, his panic attacks had almost disappeared because he had left the thoughts. It is the papancha, I think, largely around anxiety disorder that creates the problem. And if you can just come into the feeling and hang out for even a few minutes, it tends to dissipate. So, yeah, it's a really helpful concept for people to understand. Yeah, thanks. And I just want to take the last minute to say one last thing. So sometimes hearing about perception, hearing about this concept making, people think that we have to, in our meditation, stop this. You know, that we're sitting in meditation and we hear our mind going car, motorcycle, train. You know, it's like, stop already. You know, we think we're supposed to be able to stop that process. And, you know, we can kind of take the emphasis out of it, but that process is a very natural process. You know, we can't stop perception from happening. So one of my teachers, Joseph Goldstein, does this as an example. He says, okay, so you're hearing the bell, right? I mean, that's the process of hearing and the perception combined to make that happen. And now, don't hear the bell. It just happens. So it's not a problem. Well, you can't. I mean, as the gorilla example shows, we can miss things. But you know, the process of perception is something that will just carry on. Wherever our attention is placed, there will be perception around that area. So if you're white shirting it, you're noticing the white shirts, and that's what you're perceiving. And you may well miss the gorilla and the black shirts. But you will. That perception is happening. It's just. It is just a very natural process. So it's train.
I didn't hear it. That was a pig getting slaughtered.
So I find this to be a fun exploration. You know, it's so amazing when you start to do this, to see things like pigs and bats. You know, it's like, wow, what the mind does. You know, I think it's fun. So I hope that you can enjoy and appreciate this capacity of our minds and enjoy this exploration. So thank you for your attention.